Hi, my name is Kathleen Eichenlob, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. My sobriety date's January 17th, 1989. My home group's the Virginia Pacific Group. We meet in Ashburn on Sundays at 4 o'clock, if you're ever out there. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor women. And I want to thank Sam for asking me to come out and share with you. I've been sober for 23 years, and I am not easily impressed, and I have to say that he is by far the most enthusiastic speaker I have ever talked to in my whole sobriety. I was telling everybody about his message that he left and the email I got, and it was an interesting contrast because it happened on a day that I went to speak at a meeting where someone had asked me, and then he ended up not coming, and I was at the meeting like a half an hour early, and there was nobody else there, and the door was locked, and I just thought, interesting, you know? But I love your enthusiasm, and that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in Baltimore in a very, you know, average middle-class home, and, I happen to think I was born an alcoholic. I always felt really weird and really different, even as a little kid, and looking back on it now, I can describe it as, you know, I was always comparing my insides to everybody else's outsides. It seemed like they all had gotten some kind of an instruction manual when they were born that told them where to go and what to do and how to act and how to feel and what to say, and I just felt like I didn't get it, you know. And despite that, I mean, I used to get good grades and do a lot of extracurricular activities, just felt really weird all the time. And so when I was 11 years old and I had my first drink of alcohol, I loved absolutely everything about it. You know, I was outside of the roller rink with my best friend and her older sister, and her older sister gave us a few swigs off her beer, and I loved everything about it. You know, I loved the way it tasted, and I loved the way it felt when it went down, and I loved the way it felt when it hit my gut, you know, and it took away some of those feelings of difference and that fear and that anxiety that I had always felt, you know. And I mean, obviously, I didn't drink every day from age 11, but I certainly drank at every opportunity that I could, you know. And for me, there was no social drinking and line crossing. It just was alcoholic right out of the gate. I always drank from the first time until I, you know, blacked out, passed out, threw up, or just couldn't get my hands on anything else. And in a very short order, probably like within a year and a half of taking my first drink, had just thrown everything else away so that I could drink, you know. No more good grades. I just didn't even bother showing up at school half the time, you know. No more extracurricular activities. There was no time for anything except the booze and the boys. And, you know, my alcoholism progressed really quickly. By the time I was in junior high, I was you know, cutting school, you know, using other substances before school, getting, God, my mind just went blank. What do you call that? Getting suspended from school, hanging out with the wrong crowd. I think I was the wrong crowd, you know. And, you know, and it just kept going from there. And, you know, it took me a while to build up my tolerance to alcohol, but that did not stop me. You know, I mean, I remember being like in ninth grade and being over my friend's house and playing this board game called Pass Out, where, you know, you go around the board and you have a partner, and sometimes you have to drink at certain things, and there's like tongue twister cards. So, you know, you have to say these tongue twisters, and, you know, some of them say kiss your partner or whatever, and I don't know if the game is called Pass Out. I think I won because I know I was like face down in my own vomit on the board, you know, and my partner did not want to kiss me at that point. And and I embarrassed my friend, and she had to clean up after me, and I felt awful the next day, and I just did not care. I just thought this is great, you know. And I just kept going. And you know, when I was 16 years old, my dad got me this old Pinto that he got painted bright, shiny red, and he gave it to me, and we named him Petey. And, you know, it never occurred to me to not drink and drive. I mean, if you're 16 and you have a car, why would you want to park it? You know, and if you're like me, you do not think about driving it and not drinking. And, you know, the people I hung out with were pretty much like me. I mean, nobody was really interested in being the designated driver, like not even once. And I did a lot of what I call bumper cars. When I, you know, drank and drove, I hit cars, and sometimes they were parked and sometimes they were moving. And it's just kind of the way it was. I was 17 years old when I came out of a blackout on the Baltimore Beltway as I'm hitting a car in the lane next to me. And as drunk as I was, I knew that what I needed to do was to get out of there really fast, because as drunk as I was, I knew that if I were to pull over to the side of the road, which is probably what a normal person would do, that the police were going to come and that I was going to get into trouble. And I was always willing to go to any length to keep me from getting into any kind of trouble. So I sped away from there, and because I made it home, I thought I had gotten away with it, and I passed out. And I was woken up the next morning to a bunch of phone calls, because the guy got the tag number from the car, called the police. The police traced it, called my dad. My dad called me. And, like, I answered the phone, and I was half still asleep and half still drunk, and the first words out of my mouth were, "I didn't do it." You know, and that's just, you know, that is not how I was raised, but that is what I had become in short order. You know, there was no, like, no more, like, should I lie or should I tell the truth? Like, that is just what came out of my mouth. Whatever I thought was in my best interest for me, you know. And I ended up having to go to court for that. My dad hired an attorney for me. I remember putting on a little white suit before my court date, trying to look all innocent. And the attorney explained to me what the word perjury meant and how important it was that I not do that. And, you know, walking into that courtroom, I had no intention of telling the truth. I mean, I know it didn't look good because the guy, like, had my tag number, and he was in there saying, "She's the one, she hit me." But I thought, like, what do I have to lose? You know, I mean, why would you go in and tell the truth when you know you're going to get a bad consequence that you don't want to get, you know? And so I went in, and I said I didn't do it. And the judge who I went before that day was a man whose son I had dated, and he let me off. And he made a comment that he knew I had done it. And, you know, it was just one more time I thought I could do whatever I want and get away with it, you know. And that's how a lot of my drinking was. I would get into a little bit of trouble and manage to slide out without too big of a consequence, you know. And by now I'm, again, in high school, you know, cutting school, using before school, not doing my work. And, you know, I mean, I'm in public high school, but they're sending notes home to my parents saying, you know, she's not going to graduate. She's not doing what she needs to do to graduate. And I have a really big ego, and I don't like to look bad, so I did what I had to do to get what I wanted. I didn't want to be the one that didn't graduate. And, you know, if that meant stealing tests and grades and, you know, whatever I had to do, cheating to get out of there, that's what I did, you know. I thought that when people talked about having blackouts, that that was, like, BS. You know, they would make it up to, like, excuse their behavior. And you know, I didn't have blackouts probably all through high school, but I certainly started to have them. I went off to college because it's what everybody else was doing, and I certainly wasn't interested in, like, the real world. And I don't want to make it sound like I had a lot of choices. I didn't. I had one choice, and I'm sure that even that was because my mom knew several people who had gone to school there, and they wrote some letters for me, and I went to this small school in Maryland that was far enough for me to be able to live there and be out of my parents' house, but not too far away so that they could bail me out of trouble if I got into any. And it was a good place for an alcoholic like me because it was small and everything was just, like, right there. Like, you could walk from one end of campus to the other in, like, 5 minutes. And there was just, it was a really small town it was in, and there wasn't a lot of ways for me to get into trouble, thank goodness. Well, to get into big serious trouble, like if I were in a city or something. And, you know, the first day I was going to college, it was my 18th birthday, and I remember driving to school thinking, you know, you used to, like, study and get good grades and do all these extracurricular activities, and somewhere along the line, like, you got off track, and I don't know what happened, but, like, now you're 18, you're an adult, and you're going to college, and, you know, now it's time to, like, turn over a new leaf and go back to the way I was before, you know, and I really meant it, you guys. I really did. I have the best of intentions, you know, but my first night at college, I was falling down the back steps of a fraternity house drunk, and it didn't get much better after that. As if I had not been drinking enough before, this place was like an alcoholic's dream come true. I mean, there were just, you know, fraternity parties with, you know, what seemed like an unlimited number of kegs and big trash cans that they filled up with grain punch, and most of the time the girls got to drink for free, you know, and I just, oh my gosh, I had so much fun there. And, you know, my first semester in college, I got 2 C minuses, a D and an F, and when you get those kind of grades, they put you on what they call academic probation, and at this particular school, they were so tough on you that if you were on academic probation, all you had to do to not get kicked out and to get off of academic probation was to get all C's, you know. So I'd be on academic probation, and I would do just good enough to get off of it, and then the next semester I wouldn't care again, and I'd get really bad grades. And so this is how it was, like, my whole college career. One semester on academic probation, one semester off, doing a lot of summer school and whatnot to make up for the classes I failed. There was, like, this whole drop-out thing that I could never, like, wrap my head around, you know, like, you'd think I'd be a little smarter than to know, like, after a couple semesters of this, like, just don't sign up for a class before noon because you're not going to go. So then you don't go and you fail and you get an F, you know. But there was a period where you could drop out it, but it was, like, really a short period at the very beginning. I just couldn't do it. And so, you know, that was how it was. And, you know, my nickname in college was Kathy from Hell. And that's about all you need to know about me and my drinking. When I was out there, I wasn't cute, I wasn't pretty, I was anything but a lady. I have a really big mouth, too. And, you know, it really is a miracle that I didn't die out there in some of the situations that I put myself in, not just drinking and driving, but just being in places that I had no business being. But it's also just a miracle that somebody didn't just haul off and hit me, because I just would tell anybody what I was thinking, and it usually wasn't anything that was very nice. And, you know, I missed that whole cutoff thing in Maryland when they changed the drinking age from 18 to 21. And but D.C. had not changed the drinking age yet. And so we would sometimes go to D.C. to drink because we were legal there. And when I was 18, three friends of mine and I went to Georgetown on New Year's Eve to drink. And, of course, we were drinking the whole way there. And we got a hotel room. We were drinking in the hotel room. Then we went into Georgetown, and at some point we lost one of our friends. He said, "See you later. I'm going fishing." We're like, "Bye." Like, whatever. We don't care. We're going to drink, you know. And we were in a bar, and then the other two, they were done, and they wanted to leave. And, you know, here I am. I'm 18. I don't know where I am, and I'm obviously drunk. And I said, "You go on and go if you need to go, but I'm not done. I'll see you later," you know. And I was already, like, in and out of a blackout and, you know, just keeping on drinking. And then I have just these very vague recollections of the rest of the evening. And, you know, there was some guy that I was, like, hanging on to for dear life, walking, if you want to call it that, down the sidewalk because I couldn't walk on my own. And I wouldn't recognize him if he was right in front of me today. And I remember riding in the back of a cop car, don't know why. The cop took us to that person's house. I vaguely remember walking in and people being there and, you know, and then I woke up the next morning, and I don't know if you ever had this experience, but, like, where you wake up but you haven't opened up your eyes yet, and, you know, you really don't want to because it's just not going to be good, you know. And I opened my eyes up, and I was in, like, the ghetto of Washington, D.C., to put it honestly, and luckily fully clothed, and there sat my purse and my shoes at the end of the sofa that I was on. And I thought, I don't know who lives here, but I do not want to find out. And I just hightailed it out of there. Waved down a bus. I had no idea where I was. I just said, "Get me to such and such hotel." And I got there just as my friends were leaving. They were going to get in the car and go back to Baltimore without me, you know. This is the kind of people I hang out with, you know. And then at that point, it was just funny and exciting again, you know, just one more exciting night for Kathleen, you know. And I did that kind of stuff all the time, you know. In college, I was voted one of the top three female partiers in my school my senior year. And I always say it like that, but to be honest with you, I was voted third, and that really kind of irritated me that I wasn't one. But, you know, that's the way it was. I had a lot of fun, you know, and I didn't do a lot of work, and I don't deserve my diploma, but I will take it. Thank you. And, you know, I went to a school where you had to do, I was a psychology major, surprise, surprise, and, you know, I had to do a thesis to get out of that school. And as a psychology major, it involved, you know, like an experiment, come up with a hypothesis, and you would use the introductory psychology students in the study, and that was part of their requirement to pass that intro psych class, was to participate in, like, three seniors' thesis. And so it's, you know, graduation's like end of May, it's like April, and I haven't started. Everybody else is, like, all completely done. They're coasting, and I haven't done a thing, you know. And so you know, I've got this professor that I party with, this psychology professor. He's my thesis advisor, because I'm not picking the other ones who are, like, normal and doing their job. And so, you know, I mean, I would, like, be like, okay, well, what's my thesis? You know, and he'd write it down. I had no idea what I was doing. I'd be like, okay, what do I do? You know, say, well, you have to get, you know, the students to fill out your little questionnaire or whatever. And none of them would do it because it's the end of the year. They already did what they had to do, and they weren't doing any more. So I thought, well, what am I going to do now? So I just made a pitcher of kamikazes and went to the roof of one of the fraternity houses and passed out the drinks and had the guys fill out my questionnaire, you know. And so I don't know that my study is very valid, but whatever, you know. And so then, you know, I get that done, and I go to the psychology department to see him, and there's, like, the head of the department who's like, you know, just not even just Joe normal, but Joe, like, I don't like you at all because you're really strict and you give me dirty looks when you can tell I'm hungover and all that other stuff. And did not like him at all. And I walk in looking for my thesis advisor, and he said, I have bad news. He said, your thesis advisor, he had a nervous breakdown, and he's in the mental hospital, and I'm your new thesis advisor. And I thought, okay, this is not going to work. Now, there's two guys there just like me, same boat as me. And, you know, so we got together and said, this is not going to work. Like, we are never going to graduate if this guy is our thesis advisor. So we came up with a brilliant plan, only as alcoholics can do. And, you know, we got in the car with our theses and we drove to the mental hospital. And we said, look, we know you're having a hard time right now, but we really need your help. You know, so we'll just bring you our theses here so you can help us, you know. And so, and he did, you know, and he got out of there before graduation. But, you know, that is largely why I graduated when I did. I didn't deserve it. But, you know, whatever it takes. And you know, by the end of my drinking, certainly in that last year of college, I started having anxiety attacks. And I didn't even know what they were. I can just tell you that what they feel like is it feels like you're really, really stoned and you're not. You're stone cold sober. And, the only thing that worked to take them away from me was to drink, you know. I never, ever, ever, ever thought that alcohol was my problem. Alcohol is my solution to my problem. My problems come when I'm sober, you know. I never wanted to quit drinking forever because, like I said, alcohol was not my problem. However, there were many, many mornings where I'd wake up and I'd have the physical pain of the hangover and the emotional pain of, you know, the guilt, the remorse, and the shame. And I'd think, all right, just today I am not going to drink. I'm going to shower. I'm going to go to my classes. I'm going to do my work. I'm going to go where I'm supposed to go and do what I'm supposed to do just today. And I couldn't do it. I could not do it at the end, you know, because something would happen either 9 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock at night or somewhere in between where I could not stand to be in my skin sober. And I knew if I could just have a drink that it would all be okay. And it always was. It always works. You know, the problem is for me is that once I start, I can't seem to stop, you know. So there were many times where, you know, I went out for just one drink or just two drinks to take the edge off, you know. And one time I went out with my stepsister in the Inner Harbor of Baltimore for like one or two drinks to take the edge off because I was pissed off at my mom. And, you know, I woke up in a boat in the Inner Harbor, and she wasn't there, you know. I mean, this is where, like, my, you know, go out for one or two drinks gets me, you know, and I just, like I said, I just never did I think alcohol was my problem, but I tried a lot of times to just not drink for one day, and I couldn't do it, you know. I started to have the opposite effect, like where for a long time my tolerance to alcohol was increasing, then I started to have these weird things happen to me. You know, for somebody who was third top female partier in the school, I started to have these things where, like, I would go out, and I'd remember ordering the second drink, and then I'd wake up the next day, and I'd think, what happened? I must have come home really early, and I'd have to go have people fill in the blanks, which I had to do a lot, and I'd find out I was there until the bar closed, and I'd hear all these, you know, crazy things I was doing, and I would think, like, how could somebody like me black out on the second drink? That makes no sense. I'm somebody who I can drink a lot, you know, and, so I would always have some kind of a rationalization, you know. I didn't proof down. I didn't eat before I went out. Somebody slipped me a Mickey. My favorite one was that I had so much alcohol left in my body from the night before that this night it just took a little bit more to, like, re-trigger all that other stuff, and I'd get drunk fast, you know? And but it was bothering me, you know? I'm like, how can that happen? And then the next night, you know, I might start drinking at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon and drink, play drinking games, and here it is now 6 o'clock Saturday morning, and I'm only stopping because there's nothing left, and everybody's going home, and I have nothing else to drink, and I've remembered the whole night, and I haven't embarrassed myself, and I'd think, yes, you know, this is how I want to drink every day. But there's this inconsistency there, you know, and that didn't make any sense to me. But anyway, I did get out of college, and you know, I was having these anxiety attacks and trying to figure out what they were, and so I thought I was going crazy. I mean, I had like what was supposed to be like my first day at like a waitressing job or something, and I was on my way there, and I hadn't had a drink yet that day, and I just was so like overcome by feelings of insanity is the only way I can describe it, you know, and just knowing that if anybody else on the planet knew what went on in here, that they would just throw me away in a padded cell and throw away the key. And so, again, that's not a problem with alcohol. I haven't had a drink today, you know. I am crazy, but alcohol will sure make it better, you know, and so the best I could do that day was to turn the car around and go home. And I thought, well, what do you do when you're crazy? You go see a shrink. And so that's what I did, and, you know, just wasn't talking about my drinking because that didn't have anything to do with it, you know. And so now I'm still trying to find another job, you know, and I end up getting a job in a drug and alcohol treatment center, you know, which at the time my friends and I thought was pretty funny, but today I have no doubt that my higher power chose to take me there. At the time I was 22 years old, and if you would have asked me, I would have told you that an alcoholic is the old man that's wearing a trench coat, laying in the gutter, drinking out of a paper bag. And you cannot be an alcoholic if you're 22 years old and you've graduated from college and you haven't been arrested and so on and so forth. And so I started working at that treatment center, and I stole literature from them. I stole the big book and got a hold of the 20 questions, which I did not pass, you know, and I decided that self-knowledge was the answer. I decided that the results of that those 20 questions, what that meant was that I had a potential problem with alcohol if I continued to drink and that I would just stop. You know, I'm not like these people who need to go to a treatment center to get sober. I'm just going to stop. And so I tried to stop on my own. I would maybe go to like a meeting like once every 2 weeks just to check it out, you know, and I'd come in late, and I would sit in the back, and all I would hear was what was different between you and me. Seems like everybody that spoke at the meetings I went to at that time, they were like 99-year-old men who had lost, you know, their wife and their house and their job and their car and their dog and their cat and everything else, and I just thought, I don't identify with this, you know? And so I was going to try to stop drinking. However, I had what I thought was a very exciting life at 22 years old, and I went to certain bars, and I followed certain bands, and I hung out with certain people, and I had no interest in giving any of that up. I heard the people in the treatment center talking about what they did for fun when they were sober. They went bowling. And I thought, oh, just stick a gun in my mouth now and pull the trigger. You want me to be 22, not drink, and bowl for fun? I do not think so, you know. And so for the first time in my life, I was the designated driver. And I'm going to the same places with the same people. And I'm just not drinking, you know. And That went on for 90 days, and I remember telling the therapist I was seeing, you know, because I thought we were supposed to tell your therapist everything, but I said, I'm not telling those crazy people in the treatment center because they're all in AA, and they're going to say that, you know, this I have to like. Now, mind you, I'm not really in AA, but I'm catching some of the lingo and all this, and I had been counting my days. It had been the longest 90th days of my life, and I just thought, they're going to tell me I have to start all over again. And by the way, I use something else that affects me from the neck up, and that's not my problem, it's alcohol. So I'm just like, I'm on day 91, you know, whatever, I use something else, but I'm fine, you know. And, you know, there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I worked with, and, you know, we can spot each other a mile away. They all, you know, I wasn't fooling any of them. And, you know, there was a lady there who at the time it seemed to me like she was sober just forever, but she was sober 5 years. And, you know, she was listening to me moan about something yet again. And, you know, she just looked at me and she said, you know what, Kathleen, it doesn't have to be that way anymore. And I don't know why that was the thing that I finally heard out of, you know, the meetings I had been to, the literature I had read. But I heard her, and I knew that she was telling me the truth. And yet I knew that if I wanted it to be different, that I was actually going to have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and do what you all said. Now, I tried a lot of other things prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I tried the therapist. I tried church. I tried other religious organizations. I tried other 12-step programs at the time. I heard there were 76 of them out there. I tried a couple of those. I used to love to go to the self-help section in the bookstore and buy different books for my various afflictions because I have many, you know. And I just would think, oh, God, please let it be anything besides alcoholism the problem and Alcoholics Anonymous the solution. Like, let it be anything else, some weird something or other, like anything, you know. And just nothing else worked, you know. And so that's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I did. And I came really, really desperate, which is a really good way to come. And, you know, I came having those anxiety attacks. And, I mean, I just, because I was so completely out of ideas and so miserable and just such a mess, you know, I was willing to do what the people told me to do, you know. And I got a sponsor and I got a home group and, you know, I got some commitments and I started working the steps and hanging out. I was lucky that in Baltimore at the time where I got sober, there was a lot of young people there. Because I think if I hadn't been able to have some fun at 22, I don't know that I would have stayed. You know, just as seriously as I took what they were telling me to do, I also took very seriously all these things they were saying do not do, you know. And, you know, I mean, I wanted to do it all. I wanted to move out of my parents' house, and I wanted to change jobs, and I wanted the guy, you know, and they were saying not to do that, or I might take a drink. And so I took that very seriously, you know, and so I was, you know, just like a model sponsee in the beginning and, you know, still having these terrible anxiety attacks. And they went on. They didn't stop until somewhere between 11 and 12 months of sobriety. In Baltimore, where I got sober, most of the meetings I went to were discussion meetings where somebody would sit at the front and lead the meeting and then actually call on people. People didn't volunteer. The leader called on people. And I just, you know, because I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I mean, I know that even when I'm at, like, somebody's, like, 40-year celebration and that person has never met me before in his entire life and there's 200 people in the room, I know he's going to point to, like, the scared little girl hiding way in the back to share, you know? And I'd sit in the back and I'd sit behind the tallest person I could and I'd hide and I just, you know, I couldn't even imagine saying anything in front of a room of people. I just was like a cat in the middle of the freeway. I was so scared of everything, you know. But I kept coming back, you know. And I need to tell you that, like, literally every step I've taken and every sponsor direction I took, especially in my first couple of years, I took knowing that it was stupid and that it was not going to work for me. I mean, there wasn't one thing that a sponsor told me or a step that I read where I thought, can't wait to do that one, you know. You know, to say that I wasn't a rocket to stardom here is a huge understatement, you know. You know, when I looked at the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. They told me that that was the only step that I had to do perfectly, you know, because if I believed I was 99.9% powerless over alcohol, which seems like really good odds to me, especially with the bad grades I got. But if I believed that something was going to happen at some point where that 0.1% was going to get me and I was going to take a drink, you know. And I so could see that my life was unmanageable. I mean, I couldn't do a darn thing. It was so unmanageable. But I could not understand how you could possibly be powerless over liquid in a bottle. I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard of. I could tell you stories how powerful I was when I did drink, you know, and the beer muscles. And, you know, but again, you know, they said, that's not going to work, Kathleen. You can't even move on because you have got to believe you're 100% powerless over alcohol. And, you know, I thought, see, it's not going to work for me. This whole thing is not going to work for me. And my sponsor had me do a written first step, you know. And what came out in that first step wasn't the crazy stuff I had done. What came out in that first step was what I described earlier of, you know, when I take a drink of alcohol, I have no idea what's going to happen to me. All bets are off. Maybe I'll drink a lot for 15 hours straight, remember the whole night, and not embarrass myself. However, maybe I'll black out on the second drink. Maybe I'll wake up on a boat in the Inner Harbor. Maybe I will, hit a car on the freeway. Maybe I'll put my hand through a glass window. Who knows? You know, I do not know what's going to happen to me. I go out for one or two drinks and I can't stop. You know, and so that helped me to understand that I am powerless over alcohol. You know, my mom is not an alcoholic. And every once in a while, she has a glass of wine. And every single solitary time she does, that one glass of wine does the same exact thing to her. And on an even more rarer occasion, if she were to have a second glass of wine, that second glass of wine always does the same exact thing to her. And then halfway through, she starts to feel it, so she stops, you know. For me, you know, two gin and tonics one night does one thing, and another night the same two gin and tonics does something completely different. And I certainly can't stop halfway through the second one, you know. So I got to see that I'm really powerless over alcohol, you know. And when I came to the second step, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, I thought again, this is not going to work. I had always felt crazy, you know, weird, different from the time I was a little kid. And the word restored to me implied that I was going to be brought back to something previous. And I thought, well, what am I going to be restored to? The crazy 11-year-old that took her first drink, the crazy 7-year-old, the crazy 4-year-old, I don't know. You know, none of that sounds appealing to me, none of it. You know, and what I was told was that, you know, if I kept coming to AA and do the things that you all told me to do here, that perhaps I would see some sanity start to come into my life. And once again, not only did I think that was stupid, but I knew that that wasn't going to work for me, you know. But, you know, I didn't want to be the one that left without trying it. And so, you know, I decided to stay. And, you know, for me, those anxiety attacks were a very good physical manifestation of insanity, you know. And I eventually got to the point where I didn't care if they didn't even stop, because my life was better than it had been before I got here. But they did stop between, you know, 11 and 12 months. And that's when I started to see that, yeah, you know, if I kept doing this thing, that I would see some sanity come into my life. And, you know, the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I grew up with a very loving God. I never had an issue with God. My issue with God was that I was busy drinking and doing my own self-will and not paying any attention to God, unless I got into a jam, in which case I would say, God, please get me out of this jam, and then I will. And it really wasn't anything fabulous that I promised I would do, like pray or go to church or talk to him more often. It would, you know, be something ridiculous, you know. Please don't let me get caught cheating on my boyfriend, and I won't cheat on him with that guy anymore. I mean, you know, it was some really, you know, but that was the only time I remembered that there even was a God. I was just too busy doing my own thing, you know. But, you know, I had the problem that the 12 and 12 talks about when I came to that step, because I just thought, you know, if I turn my will and my life over to God, what will I be? I'll be the hole in the donut, you know. And, of course, it was pointed out to me, you know, the whole, well, take a look in the mirror and see how great things are going with you running your own life, you know. And I said, you know, I don't, and I try, I use this as an out for so many things, because the word willingness is in a lot of the steps. And to me, willingness meant when I feel like it, you know. Well, when I feel like it, I'll get up and take a shower and go to class. Well, when I feel like it, I'll do my thesis. Well, when I feel like it, I'll whatever, you know. And as a result, I didn't do much because I didn't feel like it, you know. And so in AA, I got caught up in all that. And I was like, well, I have no willingness to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And I was told to pray for the willingness. Stupid, you know. But it works, you know. And I learned a very important lesson early on, which was that, you know, we don't really care how you feel. We don't really care what you think. You need to take the action and the feelings will follow. And I had lived my whole life the opposite way. When I feel like it, I'll do it. And now AA is telling me the exact opposite, which to this day, if I really were to sit and think about it very much, doesn't make a lot of sense. But what I know is that it works, you know. And, you know, of course, that dreaded fourth step, you know, which I had been, you know, just dreading. And I came to AA with, you know, one or two of what I thought were just terrible secrets that I was going to take to my grave with me. And, you know, I swore it's not going on there, you know. And so, you know, I was told to write my fourth step, and I thought, okay, well, I'll write it, but I'm not putting that down on there, you know. And amazingly enough, it like came off my pen onto the paper. I thought, how did that happen? You know, and I thought, well, it might be on there, but I do not need to read it, you know. And I went to do my fifth set with my sponsor, and I'll be darned if it didn't just come out of my mouth, you know. And, you know, of course, what I learned was it really wasn't a big deal. You know, of course, she had the same experience. Of course, that's the sponsor that I had, you know. And it just, it took all the power away, you know. And now, unfortunately, at that point, you know, that was my big, like, my big buildup. And, oh, you know, thank God that I got that over with. And, you know, what she said to me after I read my inventory to her was, honey, you weren't that bad. And don't you know that's what I had always known all along, you know. Now, she did not say this to me, but what I interpreted from her comment was, you have no character defects and you have no amends to make. Now, this was all right around the time that I was turning a year sober. And keep in mind, I had been not moving, not changing jobs, and not dating. Now, you know, leading up to my year, you know, I was plotting all these things out. And, you know, because you all were saying don't do these things in your first year, somewhere in the back of my very sick mind, I'm thinking, well, on day 365, I'm good to go, you know. And so, like, I had it all plotted out, you know. I had a year and a day, and I had my first date with some goof I'd met in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And not long after that, I moved out of my parents' home in with a girlfriend. And then not long after that, I changed jobs and got a job I really liked where I was spending a lot of time, and you know, and I'm, you know, trudging the road of happy destiny with this guy. And you know, like 11 months, and so that is, so now here we go. I'm thinking no defects, no amends, and now I'm busy with these other things. So I didn't do a darn thing after my fifth step for quite some time, you know. And 11 months after I start dating that guy, that first guy I was dating in sobriety, you know, he's down on his knee asking me to marry him, and I'm knowing God's will. The answer is no, and out comes yes, you know. And we, next thing you know, we're like living together, and you know, the next thing I know, we're like throwing things at each other on a daily basis, and I'm like fantasizing that maybe he'll cross the road and get hit by a truck, because I don't know how I ended up in this situation, but I just want out, and I don't know how to get out any other way. Just make it all end, you know. And right around that time, I met someone from California, because I had like never made a conscious decision to do less than Alcoholics Anonymous, but all those outside things were taking up too much of my time. And so slowly I stopped going to as many meetings and talking to my sponsor a lot less. And like the only thing I had going on in AA was that I was involved in a conference, and I was hosting a speaker that came out from California. And I spent the weekend with Karen G, for any of you who know her, and she asked me a lot of questions about my program, and I didn't have any good answers for her. And, you know, I found myself asking her to be my sponsor by the end of that weekend. And, you know, I thought, this is so crazy. If I'm not using a sponsor around the corner, why do I think I'm going to use one across the country? But, you know, what she did for me that weekend is she put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous back in my life, you know, because I had forgotten how I got to get those outside things. You know, it was a result of what I had been doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I met her at 2.5 years of sobriety, and I haven't worked a step since I worked the fifth step over a year ago, and I'm not going to any meetings, I was just as completely and totally insane at 2.5 years of sobriety as I had been the first day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And when I asked her to sponsor me, she rattled off this really long list of what she wanted me to do, and I thought, did she not hear that I've been sober for 2.5 years? Like, that's what newcomers do, you know? And but what I said was, okay. And, you know, and I started doing the deal again. And all the things she told me to do were all the things I'd been told to do when I first got here, you know? And I had missed the whole, like, if I like what I'm getting, I got to keep doing what I'm doing, you know? And, you know, so she got me really busy right away, back to a lot of meetings with a lot of commitments, and back into the steps again. And and I wrote another inventory, and I went out to visit her, and I read my fifth step to her. And unlike my first sponsor, she did not tell me, oh, honey, you're not that bad. She said, you're a liar and a cheat and a thief, and she called me a couple other names too. And she had me sit there with a piece of paper and pencil as I was reading my inventory to her, and she'd stop every once in a while, and she would tell me what my defects were and to write them down, and she would tell me what amends I was going to have to make and have me write them down there, which was so smart for somebody like me who, you know, can rest on her laurels so easily. And so I left my fifth step with a list of my character defects and my eighth step list done. And literally the week before I did that with her, I was in either an eighth or a ninth step meeting listening to people share it, thinking to myself, that is so fabulous that you guys have those steps. I don't need them. You know, I have no amends I'm going to have to make, and I really thought that. I thought that if I had stolen from you, it was your dumb fault for leaving your dorm room open or leaving your clothes in the locker, whatever it was, you know. I thought it was your stupid fault. And so for somebody who thought that, I left my inventory with 76 names on my eighth step list. And wise as she was, again, she made me start making those amends immediately. And again, I was like, the willingness, I'm not willing. And, you know, she said, I don't care if you're willing. You should be willing. Go do it, and then you'll be willing, you know. And I would go talk to anybody who would listen to me, and I would think, don't you think my sponsor's wrong? Don't you think it says I'm supposed to wait until I'm willing? And nobody agreed with me, you know. Thank God. And, you know, and I started making those amends. And, you know, one of the hardest ones for me to make was the amends to my father. My dad is a very old-fashioned, stoic German Catholic who, in my mind, I was raised being taught to not show my feelings. Now, I know now that that was from an alcoholic's perception, and that may very well not be the case, but that's how I saw it. And, you know, I was so afraid. My big fear about making that amend to my dad was that I was going to cry in front of him. And I talked to people about that, too. Don't you think I should wait till I know I'm not going to cry? Yeah, no. We don't really care. And, you know, and I made that amends to my dad, and my worst nightmare came true. I cried in front of my dad, you know, and I did not walk away from that amends feeling fabulous or walking hand in hand with the sunlight of the Spirit. I walked away from that going, see, this step's not going to work. This is not going to work for me. You know, but amazingly enough, after I did it, what happened is my father started to change right before my very eyes because I had taken care of my side of the street, you know, and, we have a wonderful relationship. My dad threw a wonderful wedding for me 13 years ago, and this past January, February, he had some scheduled open-heart surgery, and, you know, I got to be there with him and with my stepmom and, you know, and drive up to Baltimore every other day to see him, and then, like, 8 days later, on the day he was supposed to go home, something happened, and he started bleeding really bad in his stomach, and they had to do an emergency surgery. And, you know, I got the call really late at night at home in Ashburn, and he's in Baltimore. My husband was out of town traveling, and I have two kids. And, you know, I thought, I can't get in the car and go. I mean, a neighbor offered to watch my kids, but my kids don't need to wake up in the middle of the night and find their, you know, me not there. And I don't need to be driving late at night when I'm worried. And, you know, what do? You know, and the only thing I could do was to pray, you know, and call my sponsor, of course. And asked people to pray for my dad, and you know, and he turned out to be okay. It was really, 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 really close, though, you know. And some of the most frightening and spiritual at the same time experiences of my entire life was, you know, being there when my dad was, you know, still intubated and unconscious, and unconscious in quotes, because, you know, I was on one side of him and my stepmother was on the other side of him, and each of us was holding one of his hands, and we would say something, and he would, if I asked him a question, he'd squeeze my hand, and if she asked him a question, he'd squeeze her hand, you know. And it was really a wonderful experience, and just, you know, proof that there's definitely a God working in my life, you know. I ended up moving to California and spending 14 years of my sobriety in the Pacific Group, and I loved it there. I loved everything about it, you know. And my sponsor was extremely active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what I still need to this day. I need to have a sponsor who has got more time than me and who's more active in Alcoholics Anonymous than I am, which is difficult, to be honest with you, for a woman with 23 years in the area that I live in, which is why I still have a sponsor who lives in California. And I don't need anybody to co-sign my BS. I still have BS at 23 years of sobriety. And, you know, it would not work well for me to have somebody sitting at home knitting telling me to go to a meeting, you know. And anyway, my point is that she was really active, and so she demanded that I be really active too. And, I think out here we call them hospital and institution commitments. Out there they call them panels or the opposite. I don't know. But anyway, she had like four of those. The most I could manage was three. And, I ended up looking for someone to speak on one of my panels after a meeting one night, and that's when I met my now husband, I ended up, taking him on the first panel, and then we went to coffee afterwards, but then I had another panel, so I took him on the next panel, and then we went to coffee afterwards, and then I had a third panel, and it was like a woman's thing. I'd never taken a man before, but I'm like, I'm going on that panel too, and went on that panel and went to coffee afterwards, he was somebody who I would have never gone out with because he just looked too nice and normal, I mean, I like the ones that have a lot of potential. They're just not doing anything with it, and he is that's not my husband. My husband is a really good guy with a good program, so for the first time in my life, I actually got to know someone before I decided to go on a date with them, which was very backwards for me. Even into sobriety, I just met weirder and weirder men in Alcoholics Anonymous than I had ever met when I was drinking, to be honest with you. We got married, and we have two kids, and I don't know if anybody ever told me this, but this is what I interpreted after I had done that inventory with Karen at a couple years of sobriety, was that if I did it really thorough and I kept doing 10, 11, and 12, that I didn't have to go back and do another fourth and fifth step. And I don't know that that's what I was told. That's what I interpreted. But, I found myself at 18 years of sobriety with two little kids at home and a husband who travels a lot and also has to get to meetings, not in a good place. At the suggestion of someone else, because I was like, I'm a hard time getting out to meetings, someone who had been in that place and her kids were older said, do whatever you have to do. If you have to take them with you, if you have to swap with somebody, have a meeting at your house and they're there with you. And so that's what I did. And I did a book and a step study at my house with 12 women and ended up going through the book and going through the steps again. And write an inventory again and read another inventory to my sponsor. And I probably would have passed a lie detector test before going into that and told you that I don't have fear. I thought fear was wimpy, Do I have anger? Oh, yeah, but anger's cool, But I thought I have no fear, And what I found all over that inventory was fear, 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 fear. I was so surprised. And I found that there's no way I could have seen what I saw at 18 years any earlier, it's that peeling the layers of the onion. And I knew that if there was that much fear in my life, that there was something not right with my conscious contact with God. Now, I already told you, I had no issue with God. I had no issue praying. I prayed every morning and every night. When I first had my first child, I realized I was going to have to set the alarm early to get up and have prayer and meditation or else it wasn't going to happen. And it was really necessary for me to do that before I hit the ground in the morning. I got to get my head screwed on straight. So I was doing all that stuff, but I knew if I had that much fear, something was not right, And I always had like a Reader's Digest version of each step, one, powerless, two, sanity, three, turn it over, and 11 to me was prayer meditation. Okay, I do that, check. But I missed the whole point that the point of it is to improve my conscious contact with God, And so I set out on a quest at 18 years to improve my conscious contact with God. And I didn't know what that was going to look like, and that is very unlike me. I mean, if I'm going to set on a quest for anything, I have a plan that I have written, and it's going to go like this. I know how long it's going to take, and I know what the end result is going to be, And I had no idea what this was going to look like. I had no idea, And also, having identified fear as the main character defect I see, what happens when I ask God to remove my defects? Well, unfortunately for me, God does not come down and go, thanks for asking, pluck, there it goes, it's gone. No, what happens when I ask God to remove my fear is I get all kinds of really fearful situations that I get to walk through, right? And so that's what happened after I identified that. And I had a lot of really fearful situations to walk through with my kids, and then we were moving, and just all kinds of stuff. And I was able to do that, and I set out on a quest to you know, just to kind of, I've really, more than anything else, been living in the 11th and the 12th step for the last, like, 4.5 years. And, you know, shortly after that, my husband got transferred here for his job, and so we've been in Northern Virginia for the last little over 4 years. And, you know, it's just my experience about how, you know, good God is, you know. I mean, seek and you'll find. And I just, so many things happened after moving here in just the weirdest coincidence way, you know, with God's hands all over it, you know, and a lot of things, you know, a lot of things have helped me with my 11th step. And, you know, I can tell you today that I certainly still have fear. I don't even like speaking at meetings, but again, early on, I was taught just do what you're asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I certainly have had fear, but I don't have the kind of fear I used to have, that I had a lot that was paralyzing to me, that prevented me from taking actions that I should take. You know, I've learned how to, you know, pray, ask for help, and just keep on walking, you know. And as a friend of mine says, and I know she stole it from somebody else, but, you know, if you find yourself in hell, keep on walking. Don't stop to hang out. Through that, like, kind of living in the 11th step for a while, I've learned, I was praying in the morning and I was praying at night, and that's great, except that for me, like, within 30 seconds, I can forget. I just turn my will over, you know? And so, you know, I've learned to pray a lot more throughout the day, you know, and it's hard at first, and I have to, like, you know, but the more I do it, it's like a snowball that keeps getting bigger. The more I do it, the easier it becomes, you know? And I'm certainly so far, from perfect, but I pray so much more now, and it makes everything so much easier, you know. Surprise, surprise, after I started doing, you know, some of the stuff I just mentioned, I started sponsoring more and more women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sponsor a lot of women, and it is the best thing ever for my program, because I was right. Alcohol's not my problem. Alcohol's been gone out of me for 23 years, but what my problem is alcoholism, and it lives up here, you know, and any time I am not thinking about me, is so good, you know. Thinking about the women I sponsor, even if it's some, whether it's some dumb, silly little thing or some big thing, anytime I'm not thinking about me, that is a solution to my problem, you know. And, you know, when, you know, different people have different opinions, but I came up with sponsorship where you talk to them about everything. And yes, I know we are not marriage counselors, we're not therapists, we're not employment agencies, you know, but, you know, the women I sponsor come to me with a lot of different stuff, and how the heck do I know the answer to whatever it is, you know? And so I'm constantly, God, please give me the words, please give me the words, please give me the words, please help me know what to say. I mean, honestly, because how do I know, you know? And, you know, for a long time into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, trying to figure out what God's will is for me. I mean, I really wanted, honestly, like a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan. I really did, you know. And I thought, what's God's will for me? You know, it's got to be something really complex and probably newsworthy and, you know, really big and exciting, you know. And I realized, and the whole moving to Virginia thing, because it's been just over 4 years, it happened in that time. So it's only been in the last 4 years. I finally realized, God's will for me is to be in love and service to the best of my ability wherever I am. It is that simple. And it doesn't just mean in Alcoholics Anonymous. It means in my home, if I'm a wife and a mom, I'm supposed to be the best wife and mom I can be. And do I fail miserably at that? Yes, all the time. But I try my best, you know. And it's to be of love and service in my church and in my kids' schools and in my community. And when I walk around with an attitude of love and service, or try to, that means I'm not thinking about myself. And again, that is the best answer for me, no matter what, you know. I always think that my problems are so complex and that they need a complex solution. And really, it's love and service, and God and AA is the answer for any of it. So if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks for having me.